One of the favorite moments for me in the life of the Buddha was the moment when he nearly gave it all away. You might think that the time that he nearly gave it all away was, you know, when he was struggling to become enlightened. But what's really interesting to me is that happened after he became enlightened. He became enlightened and then he thought, well, what should I do now? Right? It's a big problem. I know you've all struggled with that one as well. Now I've come to the Buddhist society, I've listened to some talks on Friday night, I've done meditation, I'm enlightened now, what do I do? What do you spend do for the rest of your life, right? And I really like it that the Buddha's first kind of inclination was to just take it easy. I'd just go on holiday, he thought. I'll just go to Byron and lie on a beach. And he didn't quite think that, but it was kind of that general idea. I think it was actually more on the lines, I'm going to go to a cave somewhere and meditate for the rest of my life and not have to bother with anybody. And then according to the traditional accounts of this, then Brahma himself, the great God, the creator of the world, according to the Hindu beliefs, came to him, got down on one knee in front of him and begged him, please teach, share what you have discovered. There are those with little dust in their eyes. There are some who will understand the Dhamma. Teach. And so the Buddha reflected. So it's interesting when you read these accounts, you learn a little bit about what kind of awakening is, right? I mean, the Buddha didn't know just everything automatically. He had to reflect about it. He didn't know what he was going to do. He had to think about it. Oh, what should I do? Should I just go and do a nice retreat, or shall I go and, you know, I don't know, what else could he have done? There'd be various career options to him. One time later on in the Buddha's life, again, according to the legend, Mara came up to see him. So Mara in the Buddhist tradition is the tempter, right? He's kind of like Satan, except he doesn't do like really bad stuff. He's more kind of naughty than anything else. But Mara comes up to the Buddha and says, Lord, you are the great enlightened one. You have all wisdom and accomplishment and strength and power, but it's just wasted because you're just a monk and you're just sort of sitting out in the forest and meditating and teaching Dhamma and stuff. Well, you should be a king. Rule. Yeah? Return to your home. Everybody will bow down before you and you can rule across the entire land. Justly, kindly, fairly. Seems fairly reasonable, doesn't it? Yeah. Mara always seems reasonable. And so the Buddha, as always, said, ah, you are Mara, the evil one. I recognize you. So Mara goes, drats, busted again. And he vanished, he disappeared. So that was one of the options which was open to the Buddha. He could have become a, you know, politician. It's a career path for some, isn't it, I suppose? He could have, perhaps more realistically, he could have been a recluse. According to the Buddhist tradition, there are, from time to time, like not everybody who becomes enlightened does so by practicing Buddhism. Yeah? The Dhamma is just reality. It's just the truth of things. And awakening is just realizing that truth of that. How the world is. And even though awakening is very profound and very subtle, still it's not impossible. And so from time to time there are rishis or sages or yogis or meditators or whatever who will practice and we'll see that truth, we'll realize it. In the Buddhist tradition, they're called Pacheka Buddhas. But usually, most people who do that will just stay quiet. You know, not that they won't teach or share things and so on with others, but they just do it on a fairly kind of small scale, just with the people around them or whatever. So that would have been one of the things which the Buddha could have done if he'd wanted to. Then Brahma comes and begs him to teach. And so again, according to the legend, he used his psychic abilities to read the minds of people. So this is one of the things, in according to the Buddhist tradition, that some of these kinds of psychic abilities are possible. And did the Buddha actually read people's minds? I don't know. But anyway, that's just what the text says. But one thing, you know, people often think, and in Buddhism, some people take it for granted that if, you know, if you're a monk, then you know how to read people's minds. And so they can get very paranoid when they're talking to you, right? And sometimes you're giving a Dhamma talk or something and people come after you afterwards and they go, "Oh my God, that was exactly what I was thinking about. You read my mind." But that's our job, is to try to talk about things that are relevant to people, right? That's what we try to do, is to talk about things that we hope people will be thinking about or caring about or wanting to hear about. So it's no coincidence that sometimes, occasionally, maybe it is exactly that thing. It's kind of spooky. So a lot of the times people want to learn Dhamma by having somebody read their mind for them and tell them what to do. This is an easy way, right? It's so much easier to learn how to meditate, right? Just find someone who can read my mind and then they can just say, do like this and do like that, and then that's much, much easier. One time somebody went to Ajahn Chah in his monastery in Thailand and asked him, you know, do you read your students' minds and tell them how to meditate? He said, "Here at my monastery, I teach my students to read their own minds." It's much more important. It's much better, isn't it? Even if you could find a teacher who can read your mind, what good is that going to be for you? Right? At the time when greed comes up in your mind, is your teacher going to be there to tell you? You've got greed. This is how you let go of it. If you have anger arise in your mind, right? You're driving down the highway. Someone pulls in front of you. You get angry. What are you going to do? Call your teacher up on the mobile? "Excuse me, I've got anger and now can you read my mind and tell me how to get rid of it?" This is silly. Yeah? Dhamma practice is not about reading other people's minds. It's about reading your own mind. And so people think that, you know, monks are going around and reading everyone's minds and stuff, and reality is that actually, I don't mean to be insulting or anything, but most of your minds are pretty crap. And if you've done a lot of work to get rid of greed, hatred and delusion from your own mind, why would you want to go and look at lots of other greed, hatred and delusion in other people's minds? If you had done all of that work to develop some wisdom in your mind, why would you want to go listening to all the stupid thoughts that's running around in everybody else's mind? Right? It'd be a nightmare. So even if there are people who can read minds, they usually don't want to. So you're pretty safe most of the time. But anyway, in this story, then the Buddha did look around and say, "Oh, okay, yeah, most people's minds are pretty crap. It's true, right? It is true. It's a sludge heap out there. But," he said, "there are some who have little dust in their eyes." And as always in the Buddha's teachings, there's these beautiful similes, you know, like the simile of a lotus pond. And if you go around to these countries like India and Thailand and Sri Lanka and so on, you see beautiful lotus ponds everywhere. And usually you'll see that the water is a bit kind of muddy and dark and a bit murky and so on. And then on the surface of the water, these big leaves and then these incredibly beautiful, vivid flowers that are coming up out of the water. That's a very striking image, if you're wandering through these places to see these beautiful flowers and sometimes hundreds of them. And he said, just like in a lotus pond, there will be some flowers that grow underneath the water. Some of the plants, part of the plants will grow underneath the water and you can't see them and they'll be still stuck in the mud and the mire. And some will just make it to the water. And there are others who have come all the way up out of the water and they're clean and they're fresh. And so too he saw that there are beings who had lots of greed, hatred and delusion, some who had middling amounts of greed, hatred and delusion, and then some who had only a little bit. Yeah. And there were some who saw glimpses of the truth. They saw, this is what life is made of. This is what suffering is. This is what impermanence is. They had glimpses of the truth. They had the seeds of faith, the seeds of mindfulness, the seeds of meditation, the seeds of awakening. He could see these qualities in them which could be nurtured and developed to be brought to fulfillment. So he said, okay, I'll go and teach them. And that's like a big deal, right? And that's like a lifetime's work. Yeah, it would have been, would have been so easy for him. We might think it's hard to go off and sit in a cave in the Himalayas, but for the Buddha that would have been like, that would have been the best heaven, right? He could just go and sit there in meditation the whole time. It would have been so wonderful. But instead he said, no, he'll devote his life to service, to helping others, to teaching. And so this is not an easy thing to do. Now, I'm sure that many people in this room have done some teaching at one level or another. Maybe you've done some coaching, or you've done some, maybe you are teachers, or you've done some training, or you've given some presentations in different places, and you have to kind of explain your ideas and get people to understand them. And you'll know that teaching is not easy to do, right? You know that people often don't pay attention, you know that often they're not interested, you know that sometimes you have to convey difficult ideas, and you have to know how do you break down these difficult ideas so people can comprehend them, okay? And so on and so forth. So there's a whole range of skills that's involved in teaching, which is quite different from the skills involved in mastering or understanding the subject that you're having to teach, right? So there's lots of people who could maybe do mathematics, but they're not very good maths teachers, right? Or people who can play cricket, but they're not very good cricket coaches. Yeah, they're quite different kinds of skills. And you see that today in the monastic community as well, that, there's plenty of monks and nuns who may be very good practitioners and very good meditators and so on, but it's quite a different thing than having the skill or the ability to be able to explain and convey the Dhamma to people. So this is what the Buddha thought. Okay, well, how does he do that? And again, he went through a reflective process. He didn't just know straight away, this is what you have to do. Well, he thought, who will have little dust in his eyes? And this is also quite interesting. The first people he thought about was his former teachers, Alarika Lama and Uddhaka Ramaputta. And partly out of his gratitude, okay, his gratitude to his former teachers. But also he said that they have long had little dust in their eyes. Why? Well, I guess they'd been living a life of contemplation. They'd been living a renunciate life. And it seems, well, it's not entirely clear, but it seems that they were meditators and had mastered quite a high degree of meditation. So they had long had little dust in their eyes. Unfortunately, they'd already passed away, so he couldn't teach them. Then he thought, okay, well, who do I teach? And then he thought the group of five ascetics who he'd been practicing with before his enlightenment. He thought, I'll go and teach them. And again, interesting detail that he didn't say that they had long had little dust in their eyes. He said that they'd been very helpful to me. So he wanted to teach them out of gratitude. Anyway, I don't want to go too much into the details of that kind of biography of what he did at that time, even though that's actually very interesting. But what I'm trying to get at, and what I'm trying to look at here, is what do you do when you bring your spiritual wisdom or your spiritual insights back into the world? Okay. Now I know this is something that's something I get asked all the time, right? How do you know, apply the Dhamma in your daily life? Well, first thing, I really hate the whole idea of daily life. I'm sorry. What other kind of life is there apart from a daily life, right? I just don't like that, okay? I just thought I'd just mention that just briefly, okay? It's just life, okay? In your life, how do you apply your spiritual practices? How do you bring them out of the Dhamma hall, right? You can all sit there and, oh, that's very nice. And how do we bring it and how do we apply it and how do we integrate it? And often people ask me this, you know, how do I apply the Dhamma in my life as a layperson? And I say, why on earth are you asking me? I'm a monk. If I knew how to do that, I wouldn't have become a monk in the first place. Right? I didn't know how to do that. I tried. It didn't work very well. I gave up. I thought, this is rubbish. If I want to really practice, and then I went to a monastery. I thought, this is how you practice Dhamma. Phew, now I can avoid that question because that's too hard. I'll just go and become a monk and I can practice and they've got all the support and help. It's much easier. Yeah. So, you know, you have some consideration. You know, it's your choice. If you want to come and, you know, go to the monastery, ordain as a monk or a nun, then you can do that. And then you can have all of that support and so on. But if you want to keep your lay life and your responsibilities and so on, that's your suffering, okay? So we all have it. But even in the monastery, of course, is not free from all of those things. Of course, we have to, you know, we still have issues and we have blocked toilets and all of these kinds of things. And I remember once, last year actually, I was at a Sangha meeting in Melbourne, and we were at the largest Vietnamese temple in Melbourne, and the abbot there is a very lovely Vietnamese monk, Venerable Thich Phuc Thanh, and he's one of the most senior Vietnamese monks. I don't know, he's been a monk for like 40 years or something like that, more senior than Ajahn Brahm, lovely monk. And he came and, you know, we took part in this kind of ceremony and discussion and so on with all the Sangha. And then we left. And after the end of the day, we left. And we got in the car and we turned around and... Oh, it's just when we got in the car, we realized we needed something. I think we needed some blue tack or something. Oh, that's right. I think it was the e-tag in the car was falling off, right? So we needed some blue tack or something to stick it on. So I got out and I went into the abbot's office, right? I'm sure I thought he was in his office. I was thinking he can get a bit of blue tack. He wasn't there. Somebody said, oh, look there and look there. And tried to find him. And then they said around the kitchen. So this is like 5 minutes after the big Sangha meeting and the ceremony and everything has finished. And he's in this little tiny alleyway at the back of the kitchen, up to his knees in all the grime and kitchen filth in the block drain at the back, at the back there. And, that's a real monk. So that's what it is, you know, and that's what that the life is like. This is just the reality of things. And so it's not just that lay people have to learn to do these, and that for the monastics it's just the same, really. It's not all that different in that respect. And even for the Buddha, yeah, he had to do his laundry. Yeah? You don't think about that, do you? How did the Buddha wash it? How did the Buddha do his laundry? Okay, you have this again, one of the stories that it has shortly after the Buddha was enlightened, that the Saka, the king of the gods, came down and did his laundry for him, right? And they kind of made a special rock for him to hang his robes out. And it goes into quite some detail about that. I don't believe that particular story. I don't think Saka, the king of the gods, came and did the Buddha's laundry, I'm afraid. That's a lot. I've got a lot of faith and devotion, but that's one step too far. So the Buddha did his laundry. He had to wash his clothes. He had to wash his bowl. Yeah? And when we think about the Buddha, you know, it becomes this idea. You know, the Buddha is like a manifestation, sometimes like a deity. But he often becomes disconnected. And I think this is rather a shame. I prefer my Buddha walking on the ground. Some people say, in the traditions, they say that after the Buddha was born, that he walked, took seven steps on lotuses, and that there was a miracle because he took seven steps walking on lotuses after he was born. And I think the real miracle is that the Buddha walked on the ground. That, to me, is a miracle. Yeah, that on this same ground that you and I walk on was the ground that a Buddha walked on. I think that's quite amazing. I think that's quite a wonderful thing. So when the Buddha undertook this task to teach the Dhamma and to share his teachings, it was no small undertaking. It was a great task that he did. And it wasn't as if sort of everything went smoothly. On the contrary, he ran into problems right away. Another part of the Buddha's story, which I really like, is that his first attempt at teaching the Dhamma was a complete failure. That gives me a lot of encouragement. Yeah, he, after his enlightenment, he walked to Benares to teach the group of five monks, but before he got there, he met on the road a wanderer called Ajivaka. A wanderer of the Ajivaka group, a religion called the Ajivakas. His name was Upaka. Ajivaka means one who makes their right livelihood. Upaka means almost but not quite. This is what Upaka means. It means nearly there. So he meets Venerable Nearly but not quite on the road. Yeah? Upaka. And then Upaka sort of recognized something about the Buddha. He asked him, well, who's your... He said, your face is very bright. Yeah, you have this very peaceful sense to you. Who was your teacher? Or what religion have you been practicing? And the Buddha said, Acharyo menati. I have no teacher. And I realized the truth for myself. And Upaka just shook his head and said, may it be so, friend, may it be so. And then he left and took another road. Yeah. Disappears from the story. Yeah. Almost, but not quite. Yeah. This is Upaka. So this, I think, is very nice. This gives me a lot of encouragement as someone who teaches Dhamma. Yes, it's okay if you fail. It's okay if people don't get it. Happened to the Buddha. One of the qualities which you find in the Buddha's teachings, and it took me quite a while to really understand this and to really appreciate it, I'm struggling to even to convey it or to give this impression, but there's this sense of evenness about everything that he does. Whether he's teaching something that's very, very simple. One time, for example, he was going for alms round, and on his way into alms round, he saw a group of boys who were playing at a pond, and they'd pulled this big crab out of the pond, and they were smashing the limbs of the crab. Yeah, so you know how boys can be quite cruel sometimes. Yeah, they don't really understand that you know, that this creature feels pain. They've never really thought about it. And so the Buddha came along, and this is a very interesting story. He didn't just ignore them, right? That's what probably most of us would do if we were honest with ourselves, wouldn't we? If we came along and saw a bunch of kids doing something, you'd probably say, oh, mutter, 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 and then walk on, because you don't want to get involved, right? Or what else would you say? Would you say, hey, you, stop that. Don't do that. Right? So you give orders. Yeah? So we tend to come, you know, maybe we think like parents or someone like that, we have the right to order people around. But the Buddha didn't order people around. Very interesting. You look through all of the Buddha's scriptures. Sometimes it's these absences which are the most interesting things. Right? He never bosses people around. Sometimes even the monks will disobey him. He'll say, no, 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 that's not a good idea. Yeah? The one time this monk, Meghia came to him and asked, he said, I want to go into the forest and meditate. And the Buddha said, no, no, you stay with me. And he said, no, I really want to go into the forest and meditate. I really want to put forth effort. And the Buddha said, no, no, I think it's better if you stay with me. And he said, no, no, I'm just going to go anyway. So he just went. And the Buddha said, well, if you're going to go, you just go. Right? So this is what we think that. Oh, how terrible. We think we'd never do that, right? You sure? Yeah, haven't you ever been stubborn? Haven't you ever done the wrong thing just because? Yeah? And even when sometimes when the Buddha said to do something, they just didn't do it. And he never got upset with them. No, okay. It's his choice. Yeah. He'd never say, I'm the Buddha, you have to do what I say. Very, very interesting. And this is also part of the monastic discipline. And even though sometimes the senior monks like to gloss over this part, but there's actually very fascinating. There's no vow of obedience, right? When like, you know how this whole kind of wedding thing, right? Honor, cherish and obey. Interesting, I noticed this in the Pope's resignation speech just today. This is why I was thinking of it. He promised to obey his successor, right? So even like the ex-Pope, right, has to obey. And so this is very, very important. This is about power structures. There's nothing like that whatsoever in the Buddhist discipline. None. That as a teacher, you do have no power to tell people what to do. It's a real kind of hassle sometimes, but that's just the way it is, right? Yeah? So you can, of course, you can say, you know, do this or do that, but there's no compulsion, right? There's nothing that, there's no way that you can do to force people to do what you want. And in fact, in the monastic discipline, it says that, you know, if you have good reason, if somebody asks you to do something which is wrong, which is against the Dhamma, or which is really against your conscience or whatever, then you should disobey them, okay? It actually explicitly says that this is what you should. You shouldn't follow those instructions, even if it's given by a very senior person. So this is one of those qualities of the Buddha that he would just accept. So when Meghia wanted to go off and meditate in the forest, then the Buddha said, okay, you go off and meditate. So in the Buddha's life, he met these events again and again and again. Not just once, not just twice. Many, many times. And this quality of evenness in how he would respond to things, this quality of reflectiveness, is always there. If we come back to that story of the meeting the boys in the pond. He didn't tell them what to do. He didn't say, you're bad boys. He didn't say what you're doing is wrong. He said to them, boys, do you like do you like it when people hit you? They said, no. He said, do you like, what is it like when you hurt, when you feel pain? They said, oh, we don't like it. It's bad to be hurt. And he said, what about that crab? Do you think it's just you who doesn't like being hurt? Or do you think other creatures don't like being hurt as well? And they said, well, I guess other creatures also don't like being hurt. He said, well, do you think this crab likes being hurt? Do you think that suffers when you pull its legs off and torment it like that? And he said, well, yeah, probably does, doesn't it? He said, so is that something you should be doing? They said, no. It's a bit late for the poor old crab, right? They'd ripped its legs off, okay? But anyway, the next crab was all right. But isn't that a beautiful example? It's just a little example, just a small, small thing, right? But you can see the Buddha's method. He's not telling them, do this, do that. He's not saying, this is right, this is wrong, you're good, you're bad. He's inviting them to reflect. Yeah? He's drawing out their own wisdom. Yeah? He's assuming, right, that they can understand, yeah, that they are capable of learning and growing, and that they just need to be encouraged to reflect, to think about things a bit more. That's a very positive and a very kind of empowering way to relate to other people. It's interesting to me, I mentioned a little earlier, monks or monastic discipline we call the Vinaya. Actually, it's probably a mistranslation. We translate the word Vinaya as discipline, but and then it comes, we think of hitting people and stuff. There's nothing like that. But the word Vinaya actually means to, the literal root vi means out or away, and naya means to lead. So it literally means to lead out or draw out. Yeah. And the fascinating thing to me is that that's exactly the same etymological meaning as the word education. Yeah? So you think about education, right? It's from the word e, right? The prefix e is like an out, and the word duct, right? As in to draw something out. Yeah? So to educe is to draw out. And that's what the word education originally meant. That's how, when the Greeks coined the word, that's what they meant by the ancient Greeks, is education is to draw out a person's potential. Yeah? And you see, there's a lot of similarity there with Socrates and the way that he would talk and also discuss. And he would also assume that people had wisdom and that he could draw the wisdom out. Actually, Socrates believed that everybody had been born countless times in countless previous lives, and that they had therefore learnt all of the sciences and knowledge and so on in their previous lives, and they just had to be triggered and drawn out of them. That's actually why the word education is used for that. It's drawing out the knowledge that you have inside you. And also interesting that Socrates used a similar example where he could teach a young boy, just as the Buddha would. And when he was talking about this, one of the dialogues, I can't remember its name now, and he said, okay, well, I can show you this uneducated slave boy who happened to be standing beside them, and he said he can understand geometry. And all these educated men were, that's ridiculous, you know, it takes years of study to be able to understand a geometric proof. And Socrates says, okay, well, let's test it. So he then they cleared a space on the ground and they started drawing lines and just led the young boy through each step by step to understand how it worked. And he could follow every step that they were doing. So they proved that even an uneducated kid could understand geometry. So a very similar idea to the idea of Vinaya. Yeah? So we think of like the monastic discipline, but actually is in monastic education. Yeah? It's a drawing out of a person's potential. Yeah? Enabling each person to live to their fullest. In the Buddha's act of teaching the Dhamma, of coming, if you like, out from his cave or from the forest to teach, that was an education for all of those people, but also it was an education for the Buddha. He learned as well. He had to develop all of these different skills. How do you relate to people? How do you set up a community? How do you cope with people who are doing the wrong thing? How do you best convey ideas? And when you look through the Buddha's teachings, you find a whole incredible range of innovations and developments and skillful techniques that he used to get the point across. You know, sometimes he would teach in a way that's very, very brief, just a short aphorism, sometimes very, very long, sometimes very analytical. Sometimes he would use stories, sometimes he would use humour, sometimes it would be dialogues. All these different approaches that he used, all with that one purpose, to try to get the point across. One of the points I'm trying to convey through this talk is the idea that in bringing the Dhamma into life, off the meditation cushion into life, this is not something which you should see as a watering down of the Dhamma. It's not like real practice happens on your cushion, and you know what happens out there is just a distraction. Okay, it's very easy to start thinking that way. It's like the rest of life is just, you know, it's a bit of a kind of waste of time, and if only I could meditate more, then everything would be all right. A lot of people seem to think like this. If you think like that, that is the pathway to, I don't know, certainly it's a pathway to an very unbalanced and unwholesome spiritual development. At its worst, it can lead to all kinds of emotional problems and so on. You get so attached to and so focused on this idea, this ideal of spiritual practice as meditation, that it becomes completely disconnected. You can end up divorcing your spiritual life from everything else that's happening around you. And you see these things as in constant conflict. In fact, we should see everything that happens to us as an opportunity to practice. We should see it as part of Dhamma, part of life, part of how... This is the challenge. How do we use our wisdom to understand, well, what kind of thing are we doing here? How are we applying the Dhamma in our daily life? And people ask me these questions. They say things like, how do I stay mindful? How do I stay mindful when I'm in the office and everybody's talking to me and asking me to do these things and do that and so on? How do I stay mindful? Wrong question. Sorry, wrong question. Don't be mindful. I'll tell you how. You cannot be mindful when you're in the office and everyone's haranguing you. You know that. You've tried. It didn't work. Right? Right? So is the Buddha asking us to do things that are impossible? Right? Why would the Buddha say, you know, be mindful in all of those situations, when in fact it's patently impossible? If it really was possible to be fully mindful in all those situations, why would we bother having monasteries and meditation retreats, right? Yeah, just be mindful. No. What the Buddha said in that case is we're practicing the Eightfold Path, not just one factor of the Eightfold Path. One factor of the Eightfold Path is right mindfulness. Yeah? One factor. If you're in the office and people are talking to you, it's right speech. That's what you need to practice at that time. Okay? And if you're, you know, like I've known people who they did meditation retreats and then they're like, but then I go back and I'm at work and I just want to be silent and be mindful and people keep talking to me. What do I do? Well, don't be so stuck up. Don't be so pretentious about... I didn't say this. Don't be so pretentious about your spiritual practice, right? I'm so holy, I can't talk to you because you're going to be profane and disturb my spiritual life. Really? Get over yourself, right? Someone says hi, you say hi. What's the big deal, right? So that's not the time for developing that refined mindfulness. And if you try, you're just going to cause more problems. That's the time for developing right speech, This is why I really love reading the Buddhist scriptures, and you see how the Buddha did these things. People come to the Buddha, and there's this standard phrase it uses in all the scriptures where it says, you know, they exchange polite and amiable greetings, and the Buddha said to them, you know, how are you going? Are you living comfortably? Are you healthy? And so on. So they have this kind of bit of chit-chat before they're going. There's no sutta where the Buddha says, you know, I'm being mindful, just go away and leave me alone. Actually, there is one or two suttas where he kind of does that, but only on rare occasions. Most of the time, he responds to people. Ah, that's right speech. Right speech is not less, it's not a lesser thing than right mindfulness. Right? It's very important to understand this. Practicing right speech is not, it's not like one factor of the Eightfold Path is more or less important than others. They're all absolutely important. And at that moment, when you're speaking and listening and connecting to people, then at that moment, right speech is the most important factor of the Eightfold Path. Okay? Now, the important distinction here, I hope you understand this distinction, there are factors of our practice which are more or less refined, okay? So something like right speech is less refined as a spiritual quality than, say, right samadhi, right, or something like that. But that doesn't mean it's less important. Just like in this building, you know, we have the foundations, right? And when the guys were building the foundations, well, they could be a bit sloppy with putting the cement in and knocking the nails in and stuff like that. And it can be a bit, you know, foundations can be a bit less refined, yeah, compared to, you know, when you're putting the varnish on the timbers or, you know, attaching the electrical fittings or something, you have to be much more careful. But it's more coarse, but that doesn't mean it's less important. Actually, it's just as important. This is something I learned when I went to Thailand and stayed in Ajahn Dunn's monastery for a while. And at the chores time, I had two chores. First one was sweeping, right? And in that monastery, like in many of the monasteries in Thailand, and you know, you've got these kind of big dirt roads that you have to sweep. They're quite long, and they have these long brooms with straw at the grass at the end of it. And you're probably familiar with those ones. And this monastery, they'd specially this job that they it was like the entrance road, so it was like the widest path, and they specially allocated that for the Western monks, right? Because we're bigger, okay. So there was like three or four of the Western monks there, all about my size, and we'd sort of when we were given these biggest brooms and told to sweep the biggest entrance road, and we kind of whoosh, 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 like that, backwards and forwards, and that was kind of good fun to get out and do that. And then so when that job was finished, my next job was to clean the shrine. Yeah, and on the shrine you've got all these little kind of delicate little glass stupas and relic chambers and all of these little Buddhas and so on. So what am I supposed to do? Get the big broom? Yeah? Of course not. Yeah, they had little feather dusters and little cloths and things like that that you could sweep or dust and so on. And they even had at that monastery, it's the only monastery I've seen that they actually had a special feather duster, and I kid you not, it was actually labelled Buddha's Bottom. It was Buddha's bottom. So that was for dusting the Buddha's bottom on the Buddha image. So, because it's not appropriate to use the same one for dusting his bottom as for dusting his face or something. You wouldn't do that, right? So they had the Buddha. Yeah, and that was really nice for me. It really made that idea so clear. You know, both of those things were completely appropriate for those two tasks, right? The feather dusters and the soft little cloths were perfect for cleaning the shrine, and the big brooms were perfect for sweeping that road. But you can't mix them up. You have to know what's appropriate for those different places. It's the same thing with your spiritual practice. What's that? What am I practicing now? Yeah, when you're all kind of sitting here, listening to Dhamma, you're developing your right view, yeah, understanding of the Dhamma. So you should listen, you should reflect on it. Right? This is not the time. We just did some meditation a little bit earlier. That was the time for being very peaceful and making your mind completely silent. Now is it not the time for that? Now is the time to investigate. Is that right? Does that seem reasonable? Is Sujata just full of it? Right? Or does that kind of make sense? And you kind of reflect on it. Say, well, how does that... Oh, that makes sense of what that happened. And so you can reflect. And that's developing your right view. So this is something that that comes across in the way that the Buddha lived when he brought that Dhamma back and applied it in society, applied it to people who were mad, applied it to people, to children, applied it to women weeping in grief when they just lost their family, when he applied it to nations who were wanting to go at war, when he applied it talking to kings, he applied it talking to outcasts, to the poorest of the poor, to sick people, to people on their deathbed, in so many situations, again and again and again, anything you can imagine. And he would always find something that was appropriate and suitable to say at that time for that person. And this is a very discreet quality. It's not something that sort of leaps out at you. It's something which you could gradually learn and get an appreciation for over a long period of time, getting familiar with how the Buddha worked. And so this is one of the really lovely things that I've learned from studying what the Buddha taught, studying the suttas, studying the Buddhist scriptures, seeing how he took those and applied them in so many different circumstances. So our question really shouldn't be, you know, how do we apply this Dhamma in our lives? Because that's already kind of assuming that the Dhamma and our life are two separate things. A better thing to do, I think, would be to start by saying, remember that assumption. There are some beings with little dust in their eyes. Right? Even those little boys, stupid, cruel, little delinquent brats playing, killing a crab. And the Buddha saw the goodness in them. He reached out to that goodness in them and he touched the goodness in them and drew it out. Yeah, he drew it out, like he educated it, he vinayed it, he drew it out. In just the same way, each one of you has goodness in you. Each person sitting here has wisdom in you. Each person here has love in you. Each person here has that quality of caring, of letting go, of contentment, of understanding, of compassion. So to me, this is a much better question to ask. Not how do I take this Dhamma and put from one place and put it into another. No, how do I find those seeds of all those good things, those seeds of wisdom, the seeds of stillness, the seeds of compassion, the seeds of joy, where are those? And how can I bring them out now in this situation with these people doing this task? How can I find what are those seeds? How can I draw them out? How can I manifest them? Not so that I can be somebody else, not so that I can have some ideal of a Buddha or a Buddhist or something like that. I'm a Buddhist, so I don't get angry, right? No. Not so you can meet this ideal, but how you can become more of who you already are. This is this word bhavana. We have this word in Pali. It means bhavana. Usually they're translated as meditation, okay? But actually the literal meaning of the word bhavana is making more of something. Okay, so meditation is making more of your mind, making more of wisdom, making more of loving kindness, making more of compassion, making more of equanimity, making more of discernment. How can I find these qualities in me and make more of them? draw them out, allow them to reach their fulfillment? This, I think, is the question we should be asking. So this is my talk for you this evening, and I hope that's been enjoyable. And if anybody has any comments or questions or any good jokes, then now is the time. It looks like we've got a couple from... questions from internet land, is that right? Yes. Thank you very much. Okay, question from Dhirayupa. Hello again, Dhirayupa. Since there is no authority or leader, what mechanism will ensure that some monks don't get too off the path? E.g., there's a monk in Thailand who chants only 150 of the rules of the discipline instead of 227. Okay. Well, I mean, in a sense, I think that question is coming back to that whole kind of thing of authority. I mean, the practical reality is that over the years that it has been necessary to exert some kind of authority and control over the Buddhist community when things get a little bit too out of hand. And there's always this kind of feeling of wanting to do that, but on the other hand, it never actually seems to work, sad to say. And the reality is that according to the monastic discipline, that really you can't do all that much. That the monastic discipline is, or the monastic vinaya, the monastic education, let's call it, I should be consistent here, education, is really relies on sincerity and good faith and goodwill. And if you don't have those, there's not much you can do, actually. So if a monk or a nun is just really badly behaved and is not going to do the right thing, well, at the end of the day, what can we do? Right? So... there are limits, yeah. However, I think it would be wrong to underestimate the strength in that. You know, we think that's a weakness, the fact that we can't discipline people and make them do things and so on. But you know, just stop and think for a moment. The Buddhist Sangha actually exists, right? After 2,500 years, right? How many institutions of humanity still exist after 2,500 years have been able to adapt to so many different cultures and customs and so on? My goodness, it's absolutely astonishing. And so there's something to that. There's some resilience. There's some adaptability. There's some flexibility there which has enabled it to survive. And so this is why I'm not really too much worried when you get people who, you know, maybe do the wrong thing or something like that. Things will work themselves out. Yeah, I mean, of course, we should do what we can, but at the end of the day, things will work themselves out. Okay, so Dhiriyu is referring to a monk in Thailand who only chants 150 Parimokkha rules instead of 227. Okay, so that might sound like... that's like really, oh, that's good. We can get rid of some of the rules now. If we only have 150, we've got rid of, what's that, 77 rules. Excellent, yeah? Finally, we can chill out and relax. That's really good, yeah? But hang on, if you actually look at what's going on, it's not quite like that. Actually, most of the rules which they've got rid of are actually just things like table manners and stuff. So it doesn't actually mean... I doubt very much if the monks who are doing that are actually got worse table manners. But it's rules like, you know, I'm not going to slurp my drinks when I'm drinking them, or I'm not going to chomp my lips when I'm eating, and so on. These are some of the rules. So I think we can safely say that not reciting those is not going to make too much of a big deal. Actually... in the earliest times, it seems very likely that there actually was only about 150 rules, and this is actually referred to many, many times in the early scriptures, that on the fortnight that the monks would recite about 150 rules. And what tended to happen, actually, if you look at the existing code of discipline, it's divided into different sections. And the main sections of it actually total pretty much 150 rules, and then there's an extra 75 rules or so, which mainly deal with very minor matters of deportment and, like I said, table manners and things like that. It seems that that list was added sometime afterwards, and that the original recitation didn't include them. So this is the reason why there's some kind of reform movements to only recite the 150 rules rather than the 227. Anyway, if you have to learn the rules, right, those we recite them off by heart, okay? When we say reciting them, you have to actually learn them off by heart and recite them. And so if you have to learn 227 rules in Pali, you'll be looking for any excuse to trim them down a bit, let me tell you. Okay. So this is to Kusala from Italy. Hi, Kusala. How are you going? Ciao. When talking to people in the office, if you are still aware of what is arising and what is passing away, isn't it considered being mindful? Thanks. Yeah, sure. So you can, of course, you can be mindful. I mean, it's not just arising and passing away, but you can be aware of touching things, you can be aware of hearing things, and you can be aware of mindfulness in all kinds of ways. All right? But so my point isn't, I was sort of exaggerating to give you a bit of emphasis to make a point there. But the point is, like, what is your focus at that time? So if you're talking, then your focus, the main thing, is your right speech. So if you want to say, actually, you should be mindful of how you talk and so on, yeah, sure, you can use it in that way. But the point that I was really making was a contrast between, especially when we go on to meditation retreats and so on, that we think of mindfulness as being very refined. Yeah, we try to be aware every step that we take, reach every movement, you try to be mindful, every thought and so on. And if you really try to do that, yeah, outside of the specialized environment of a retreat, then usually you'll end up failing, and then you get depressed or think that you're no good or think that it's hopeless or think your practice isn't getting anywhere. The important point, the main point I'm trying to get across is that the Buddha always taught us to do what is appropriate for that time and place. Right? So if you're talking, that is your practice. It's not that you should be trying to talk to someone and then in the back of your head you're trying to be aware of rising and falling because that's what you did on a meditation retreat, right? And that's your real practice. No. When you're talking to someone, you be aware of talking to them. That is your practice at that time. Okay, so hopefully that's clear. All right. Any questions? Yes, I think we have to wait for the microphone.
Thanks for the talk.
Yeah.
My question is about the different kinds of love, because your talk was a little bit about appropriateness and balance and sort of responding to the situation. And so the types of love in Buddhism, it's been a while, but I remember them: compassion, equanimity, sympathetic joy, and metta. Yeah. When you're relating to people, it seems to me that it can be useful for one form of love would be more useful in certain situations. And that balance, how do you balance that kind of stuff? How do you choose?
Just be natural. You don't choose, just be natural.
Especially with like problematic relationships, because sometimes you need to step back.
Sure.
And to me, that seems like a really...
Yeah, I mean, when it gets difficult, then sometimes you need to kind of reflect on it more and be more careful, right? But, you know, you shouldn't go around trying to micromanage all of your emotions and stuff, you know. Just feel what feels like, okay, it feels like that. And, you know, if there's difficult connections, I mean, if you feel anger to someone... 99% of the time you feel angry to someone because you care about them, right? You don't care anything about them. You couldn't care what they believe or what they say or what they do, right? It's only the ones that you love that you get angry with. So if that happens, then that's the first thing that you should do is just reflect, oh, okay, that's why what that person does really annoys me. It's because I actually care for them, yeah? And so you sort of make contact with that. That's a starting point, yeah? So... Yeah, I mean, I don't like to give too much specifics in these, because to me it's just, it's so much changing and it's so personal and it always, it's just different every time. So you just have to see what works. If you, if you're looking specifically for ways of helping to overcome anger, the best guideline to that is, for me, is in the section on loving kindness meditation in the Visuddhimagga, in the Path of Purification, which is the classic Theravada meditation book, and it's got a great section on everything you should do when you feel anger. And it's so good because it gives you that, you do this one, and if that doesn't work, then you try this, and then you reflect like that, and you reflect like this, and you do the other one. And it's got so many methods that by the end of it, you're guaranteed to have forgotten what you were angry about at the beginning. Yeah? It is absolutely going to work in every case. Yeah. So you just have to, this is, you just learn. Again, education. In that situation, you find, what is that best quality that I'm bringing here now? Not what I should bring, right? But what am I bringing here now? If you've refrained, yeah, this is a great, there's a great sutta called the Punavada Sutta, and this monk called Puna. I always remember this sutta because when I was first monastery I was at was Wat Nanachat, and we actually had a monk there called Puna, right? He had the same name as the monk in this sutta. And this monk Puna was Canadian, okay? And this monk Puna in the suttas came to the Buddha and said that he wanted to take the leave from the Buddha because he wanted to return to his home country, which is a wild, barbarian frontier land. Okay, so this Canadian monk also did the same thing. When he took his leave from the community, he came and he actually read the Puna Sutta because he had to go to the wild and barbarian frontier land in northern Canada, which actually is a wild barbarian frontier monastery. So, and the Buddha said, well, what if you go there? What happens if people yell at you? And you say, oh, these people are so good, they're so kind, because they don't throw sticks at me. Right? What if they do throw sticks at you? You're saying, ah, oh, these people are so good and they're so kind because they don't throw lumps of dirt at me. What if they do throw lumps of dirt at you? You think, oh, these people are so good and so kind because they don't throw rocks at me. But what if they do throw rocks at you? Ah, oh, these people are so good and so kind because at least they haven't stabbed me with a knife. But what if they do stab you with a knife? You think, oh, well, life's got to end sometime. Yeah, I had a good go. Yeah, so whatever that situation, you bring out what's the best you can bring from yourself in that situation. Yeah? So notice what the Buddha's recommending there. He doesn't say be mindful of the feeling. Yeah, very, very important to remember this. You can't reduce the whole Buddha's path to just one thing. He doesn't say be mindful of rise and fall. Yeah? Because that's not the issue. The issue is that when somebody threatens you like that, you feel fear. You feel anger, right? That's the issue, right? Not mindfulness of touching or of rise and fall or something. The issue is that you have that unwholesome emotional response. So how do you deal with that at that time? Okay, next question. Eddie. The irrepressible.
Thank you. Ajahn Sujato, You know, different people, they approach the people approach the Buddha's teaching in different ways. Yeah. I find, you know, if we were to sort of, summarize, you know, or go into the heart of the Buddha's teaching, you know, okay, We should be looking into things like, number one, the four foundations of mindfulness from the Satipatthana Sutta, okay? Second is the five aggregates. The third one is the Pujangas, seven factors of enlightenment, you know. If you can correlate all these three things, okay, and then, like from the vipassana meditation, that is insight meditation, okay? Practice that, this thing, and relate to our daily life experience, you know? We could just, there could be, how do I say this, a lot of wisdom to be get from there. And it says that if you can understand all these things, it leads to enlightenment, nibbana, which is end of suffering, happiness. What do you think?
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Sorry, can just, yeah. It sounds complicated. If you could Google, you know, these things, what I said is true, you know, and look into it, you can see a pattern there, people.
Sure, sure. You can always see the connections between these different dhammas. Yeah, this is also a very, very, very interesting aspect of the dhamma. When the Buddha taught, you know, when you first encounter the dhamma, you get all these different lists. And he's mentioned a few of them there, you know, the five aggregates, the four satipatthanas, and so on and so forth. And at first, it seems like these are just kind of different things, right? There's four of this and the four of that, and they don't seem to have any connection. But the more you go into it and the deeper you understand it, you realize, there's the same patterns coming up again and again and again and again. And that there's a meaning for it. There's a similarity between all these different things, but also that there's a reason why that they are different, right? They're not just the same thing in different words, but they are each looking at the same truth from a slightly different angle. Yeah. So this is one of the great avenues for giving rise to wisdom in Buddhism, is to look at how all these different approaches to the Dhamma how they relate to each other, and why they're taught in different ways at different times and different places. Yep. Okay, so if there's no more questions, good, we will finish off. Any more announcements? I think announcements finished at the beginning. So let's finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem.